We turn in a moment to 1 Peter, chapter 1 and 2. Richard, thank you, first of all, for your very warm welcome. Warm is the word here. See everybody fanning themselves up there. It's great to be back with you. And I was terribly impressed to hear that my successor speaks in tongues here in the pulpit, as you did just now, quoting other languages. It makes me a little hesitant about how I respond to your welcome. I remember the problem of a European who went across to Korea to speak, and the Korean interpreter was following him as closely as possible, and the man said, "My wife is tickled to death to be here." And the Korean interpreter had never heard that idiom before, so he translated it literally, "I had scratched my wife until she died." So in such an international gathering as this, it's a little hesitant to know what to say, except thank you for a wonderful welcome. And of course, Myrtle and I are delighted to be back with the family. At least a third of our ministry was here at All Souls, and so it was a very formative time for us and for our family. It's also a very special sense of what this family means to so many people. Some of you here, the older set, as it were, will remember that tremendous moment when a Biafran student stood here on his last night after the Biafran-Nigerian War, and he said, "When I came here and came to London, eventually found this church, people kept saying about the church family." He said, "I kept looking for it downstairs. I kept looking for the church family." He said, "Then I realized I could be part of it." And what it had meant to him, and what it's meant to so many people, to be part of this family here in London at All Souls. Now, Charlotte's, in a sense, temporarily, or just momentarily, in a sense, launched into this family before they go off to train at Wycliffe. But she's also, in a sense, launched into two other families. She's launched into our human family, and that's quite a family. She's already on her parents' passport until she's old enough to have her own. And she's all sorts of things to discover about the family. We'll tell her one or two things about her dad, in particular, as she grows up, and about her mum, but we'd be more hesitant about that. Of course, there are parents and godparents and uncles and aunts and cousins. They go on endlessly. As I found when I married Myrtle, they go in, you found them everywhere. You turn them up under a boulder in the Sahara Desert, they'll still be a member of their family. So she's got a lot of people to discover in the human family. But she's also been launched today into the Lord's family. We welcomed her into the Lord's family in baptism. And in a sense, she has been added to her parents' Christian passport today until she's old enough to have her own when she confirms it publicly. And she's all sorts of relatives to discover, the great saints of the past and present, the Abrahams and the Moses and the Peter and the James and Johns and John Stotts and all the rest of history. What a lot she's going to discover of this exciting and wonderful family, this international family into which she has been welcomed today. However, someone's baptism is a moment for us, as Richard was saying earlier, to recall what it means for us to be members of the family of God. And this wonderful phrase that comes in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 10 says, "You are God's people." It's a stunning phrase. And it's a good moment this morning, rather rapidly, just to do a health check on some of the things that Peter tells us are marks of being God's people. Now, I'm going to range across the two chapters here. Firstly, we are to be a people of celebration. Now, when I served here in All Souls, there was a great tradition in the office back here, it probably still exists, to have any excuse for a party. That's why I put on weight here. We are having cakes almost every day. We thought of anything for a party. It's a great habit. Now, the people of God are to have a celebratory spirit. Many of you will know Michael Saywood's book on how to become a Christian, which he actually entitles, "Come to the Party." The very opposite of what most people think Christianity is. Come to the party. And this, of course, springs out of that the stories that Jesus himself told. The lost coin and the lost sheep, what happened in both cases, they threw a party. Everybody crowded in. And Jesus said, "Exactly. I tell you that before the angels of God, that happens over one sinner who repents." So heaven must be one glorious party, celebrating those who've come to faith. And then, of course, he told the story of the prodigal son. And how did that end? With a party. Kill the fatted calf, welcome everybody in. It was only the other son who didn't join in. Eat and be merry, it's a celebration. In a sense, Richard, it occurred to me in preparing this sermon today that when you welcome new believers into the church here, though you want to get them, obviously, into beginners groups and all the rest of it, you should first have a party. There should be a party every week to celebrate those who come to faith. That would be very scriptural and a good excuse for a party. Now, this spirit of celebration is quietly, persistently through this passage. Matthew Henry, the ancient commentator, says of this passage, it is a congratulation of the dignity and happiness of the state of believers. Now, there are three things in particular that Peter picks up that have happened to you and to me as God's people. Baptism happens to us. You cannot baptize yourself. That's in the symbolism this morning. As we put the water on Charlotte's head, it was something that had to be done to her. And three benefits that come here are all things that happen to us as the gift of God. First, in verse 3 of chapter 1, is that we are born anew. We've just been on a chaplaincy in Switzerland, no surprise, as we try and go most years there. And after someone had listened to the sermons morning and evening for 2 weeks, he said, may I ask you a question? Not that I'd raised this particular subject, but he said, may I ask you a question? He asked me lots of questions, but one was, what are these born-again Christians? Well, I knew what she meant. It's being grabbed as a label, rather like Hoover is for vacuum cleaners. And for ancient people, biro still is for pens. It has been grabbed. Unfortunately, it has, because it is a word that belongs to the New Testament. It belongs to the Anglican Church. It was in the service this morning. And you know, as well as I do, that this comes when a person turns to Christ. The seal of it is that God enters the person's soul and life and brings their spirit to life by the Spirit. It seems impossible to those who don't experience it, but to all of you here as God's people, you'll know what it means and what it meant to you, perhaps suddenly, perhaps gradually, that you came alive by the Spirit of God. Isn't that so? What was it that struck you first of all? I'd love to go around and ask you. Was it the Bible opening up? Was it a sense of worship? Did you suddenly realize what it was all about? Did you sense something of what it meant to belong to God? Was there a new skip in your step? There are all sorts of things that happen. Conviction, illumination, teaching, joy, as the Spirit of God moves amongst us. Remember one night, a fellow right up there in the back row, don't worry up there this morning, but he was right up there in the back row, suddenly ran down those steps, out here and straight out through the church. David Chapman, the church warden, rushed after him thinking he was ill. But he said, no, he said, God has met with me. He said, and I've got to get out of church. Well, we knew what he meant. It was part of the Spirit of God in him, answering to the Spirit of God. Then in verse 4, there's the inheritance. These amazing words, an inheritance. Now, Charlotte has an inheritance. Imperishable, undefiled, unfading, kept in heaven or reserved in heaven for you. Incredible statement. Reserved in heaven for you. Wow. Got your name on it. Make sure you're there. It's reserved in heaven for you. It's a wonderful thing, isn't it, on a journey, a long journey, perhaps a complicated journey, when you've gone through all sorts of problems and difficulties and the plane has broken down and everything else. But eventually you arrive and you come through eventually the final doors, and there are your relatives or your friends waiting to meet you. And you know they're going to be there. You know that the place is ready for you, and the room will be ready, and the place will be prepared. There'll be clean sheets on the bed. You know that's there, whatever the journey is like. God says, see that. When you arrive, you will be welcomed. Just imagine what it's going to be like when you go through immigration. Don't need a passport. And then you'll be welcomed. What a wonderful sense it is of the great reunion together. You will be expected. That's what it says. And this lifts this limited life into something of eternal perspective for Charlotte, for all of us who belong as the people of God. Now, don't come back at me afterwards and say, you Christians are always so heavenly minded, etc. You're no earthly use. I remember, I think it was Soper on Tower Hill when some man said to him, now, he said, supposing when you get to heaven it isn't there. Soper, quick as a flash, has always said, well, if it isn't there, I still had a great time not getting there. Of course, it's wonderful to be a Christian in this life, but the fact of eternity is there and takes the whole sting away and makes this a marvellous life going on with Christ forever. Rejoice in it. Don't be ashamed of it. Rejoice in it. It's a wonderful thing. And then thirdly, in verse 5 of chapter 1, guarded. Guarded all the way. Someone with you. Someone coming to help you. We were going on a journey the other day, and the person handling that air company at Manchester Airport happened to be a reader in the Church of England. So we got rather nice treatment. It was rather nice, actually. Picked us up out of the queue and moved us to another desk and gave us a VIP thing to go into the place to have coffee beforehand, not much time, but we enjoyed the fact that he looked after us. Rather naughty coming back, it all worked the other way. It didn't even know we were coming. But going out, it was all right. And it was a wonderful sense, which we all have when someone is with us. God says, I'm with you all the way. And particularly if you look at verse 6, in the midst of suffering and pain and grief, joy stays under the surface, even when the storms and waves overwhelm us. Joy for the Christian is not geared to circumstances. There is a sense in which many of our ups and downs of feelings are geared to circumstances, inevitably, but the joy of the Christian is underneath. It's rooted in God. It cannot change. It is there deep down, however much the waves on the surface are raging. And we're able to rejoice in him always. Look at verse 8. You love him, you believe in him, and rejoice with unutterable and glorious joy. Great. People of celebration. First health check. What's a celebration like? How'd you come into church this morning? Thrilled? Well, I hope you'll go out being thrilled anyhow, even if you didn't come in like it. Be celebrating this week. A people land of affirmation here. As you look down this passage, you'll see that it's also important for us to have a great sense of the roots. I often heard Richard say this, it's very important to have a sense of history. I was told of a friend in Edinburgh the other day, and American friends here, forgive me, I'm always embarrassed, constantly embarrassed at English tourists, and you must be at some of your fellow Americans, so you'll allow this within that context. But this chap was standing, showing a friend of his round Edinburgh, standing on the castle parapets. And next to him were two American ladies. And one said to the other, dang me, she said, it's the strangest castle I've ever seen. Fancy building it so close to the railroad station. Now, a sense of history actually helps you. And if you're to celebrate as a Christian, you are rooted in history. And all the historic facts here, there are four of them, God himself, the resurrection, the shed blood of Christ, and the person of Jesus Christ are all under attack. That God isn't, first of all. But here it is, a celebration, verse 3, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. I hope you're like the boy who added wonderfully at the end of his prayer and very theologically, oh, by the way, Lord, do look after yourself, for if anything happens to you, we're done for. A man, a fellow, a young person, a boy, in fact, who had that trust in God as God. Verse 3, in the resurrection. You know how it is with plays about Jesus, musicals about Jesus, films about Jesus, they all avoid the resurrection. Because if you believe the resurrection, it is dynamic in its impact. Cannot avoid it. You cannot avoid what it means. Now here it says it's through Christ's resurrection that the heavenly Samson breaking into the gates of Hades and pioneering the way for us to follow. Verse 19, it's through the precious blood of Christ. I've even heard people in the church recently say, well, the days of sin and salvation and the cross and all that lot, it's all gone, you know, that's old past, that's old hat. Don't think in those terms anymore, don't we? Oh yes, we do. And those same people actually come to the Eucharist, to the communion, and take the bread and the wine as the body and blood of Christ. I don't know how they do it. This, again, is where we stand. And fourthly, the Son of God, chapter 1, 21 and 2, 6, the cornerstone. And this says, verse 21, is why we have confidence in who he is as the Son of God. That is the seal. So, affirmation is part of our task and part of our responsibility. It's part of our joy. Thirdly, we're to be a people of transformation. Verse 13 of chapter 1 through to 2, 3. Now, it's always a bit embarrassing when we go off to Switzerland from Manchester Airport. It's not a nice airport, it's quite nice. It's a very good airport. The flight goes very early in the morning, so you get there at about 6:45 in the morning, and it is just slightly embarrassing because Merton and I have rucksacks and walking clothes, and we have our mountain walking stick with its point on the end, and if necessary to beat the weight in the cases, we even carry our boots. And then you sit down, you know, while you're waiting for the plane, or in the main area where all the other people are waiting, and there are people in flowery shirts and shorts and trainers. They're going to Mallorca, of course, and you're going to Switzerland. And then you get the businessmen, all in their smart suits and their cases. I don't know where they're going. Well, some will go to Zurich, I suppose. And then you separate according to your destination. Where you're going affects how you travel. Now, this is true here. If you look down in these verses from verse 13 onwards, you'll see that there is a great sense of realizing that not only is the joy ahead of you, but there's also the answerability ahead of you as a Christian, of the way in which you and I have lived as a Christian in the one life He's given us to live. Now, this is the seriousness of the passage here. Why it requires a transforming lifestyle. And most people in this country don't bother about God, they don't bother to worship, they don't believe Christ is the Son of God, they don't take the cross and resurrection seriously, they don't think there's any final judgment, and the word of St. Paul exists, there is no fear of God before their eyes. And if you have no fear of God before your eyes, then you don't bother. Now the Christians are removed from fear over salvation, but not over answerability. Look in verse 17. There is to be a fear. Paul says in 2 Corinthians that this is what gets him off his backside when he realizes the fear of God, not for other people, but for himself, that he's been given a job to do and he needs to do it. And this gets him on the way. So when you look at this passage, there is no place here for a fizzy Christianity, a sort of Jesus happy hour type of service. It's nor is it God just as a heavenly chum. Here there is awe and reverence and a sense of who God is. Now Peter presses the point. Verse 13, the end of the journey affects how we live. Gird up your minds, think soberly, that is, clearly. The one we call Father, he says in verse 17, which is a wonderful title, is also the one who will judge our deeds as Christians. Between wood, hay, stubble, gold, silver, precious stones, to use Paul's phrase. What's needed? Well, in verse 14, non-conformity. You understand what I mean by that, of course, I speak as an Anglican bishop. Non-conformity. Verse 14 is that we are not to be conformed to the passions of our former ignorance. Verse 18 says, futile ways. The daring to challenge the peer pressures that are brought upon us, now with tremendous and growing force. Some of you remember the night here in All Souls, at a weeknight, when we had a gathering about television. We had the leaders, the chairman of the television authorities, BBC, the IBA and so on, and Malcolm Muggeridge delivered a lecture. And in the middle of the lecture he said, television is like this. He didn't like television. He said it's like the goldfish in the bowl. As the water is slowly heated, the goldfish doesn't notice any difference until it expires. And he said that is what television is doing to this country. It is moulding people in such a way that they do not realise the destructive effect it's having upon thinking. Now, the chairman of the IBA and the BBC were absolutely explosively livid in their reply. But Muggeridge is right. Even last Sunday night they put out a programme that damned the Church of England in such a way it was absolutely obscene in the way in which it misused facts. People write to me to say, I didn't know the Church of England was in such a dreadful state. Well, there are many things wrong with it, but not the way in which that programme portrayed it. So once again, the heat is there. Non-conformity to peer pressure on values morals, standards, they're all around us. We all do it. Why don't you? Then there's conformity in verse 15, a conformity to be holy as our God is holy, the daring of a Christian lifestyle. And then there is in verse 2 of chapter 2 this wonderful description of how we're transformed. Like newborn babes, we long for the pure spiritual milk. Now, Rachel, you'll like this. Matthew Henry says of this, infant desires for it are fervent and frequent. Remember that at 4 o'clock tomorrow morning. It's difficult to keep abreast of demand. Okay, now is that true of you? Because Peter does not go on to say, go on to meat. He's using this for all your life. Is it difficult to keep abreast of your demand for the word of God? Do you still want to study it, read it, examine it, meditate on it, grasp it, learn it, inwardly digest it, fervently and frequently? That's what Peter says. You are never to cease to be like a newborn babe. Every time you see a babe feeding at the breast, think of this text. Am I still like that? Lastly, we are to be a people of dedication. Paul has to say, I appeal to you. One night there was a St. Paul oratorio in this church. In the middle of it, I preached here on Paul as the slave of Christ. I went to the door, and the first person out bearing down on me was livid. Caught me by the lapels, used to wear robes in those days, caught me by the lapels, and he said, how dare you call me a servant or slave of Christ? I'm a child of God, made free by the grace of God. How dare you call me a slave? So then I grabbed him by the lapels before he could get down into Regent Street. I said, just a minute, let's try and get this clear. Of course you are. By the grace of God, you're made a child of God. But remember in Romans, after he's expounded the gospel, he says, now I appeal to you. There's no forcing, but there's an appeal to commit yourself in dedication. That's when you accept servanthood back again, but freely. Here in verse 4, he says, chapter 2, come to him and like living stones, be yourself built into a spiritual house. Now there's the invitation. You have to come. You have to come. You have to say to Christ, I mean business with my life, just as we have marked Charlotte's forehead with the cross today, in token that she should be a soldier and servant of Christ to the end of her life. She has to take that on, as well as believing in Christ, in the fullness of her Christian life. There isn't really time to spell this out now, it's too much, but just to glance your eye across this wonderful passage, there is a permanence here we're supposed to have as stones in the building. In this building, somewhere under the earth for 150 years before we pulled them out and made the Waldregrave Hall, others have had a cozy life. Others had to put up with the landmine. Others have had to weather the weather outside. But all have a part to play. So in the Christian life, some are martyrs. Some have to be in the front line. Some have a reasonably comfortable life as Christians. But what God calls from every Christian is what he calls faithfulness, that he can rely on us. Rely on us. Can he rely on you? All the way to the end of your life, he can rely on you. You're a stone in the building. That's the permanence idea. Of course, you're a living stone. A vicar who's just about to retire in my diocese, only this week I sat with him. He cried, feeling the bitter opposition these two very difficult village churches. He felt he'd failed, but he hasn't. That man has been faithful. Then we're also to be, and cannot take much time in it, priesthood. It says here, that's women and men, to offer spiritual sacrifices, lives of commitment, bridges of love, the hands and feet of Christ in a needy world. And then in verse 9, the proclamation that Richard quoted earlier, the sharing of the gospel, a readiness to speak for Christ. Many people are afraid to do this. Why? Here there's a great note about it. Look, it describes it as the wonderful deeds, look at it, into his marvelous light. That's pretty extravagant language. Wonderful deeds, marvelous light. There's something catching about it, which ought to be about proclamation. We went up on the train up the Jungfrau while we were on holiday, because we get a free ticket as a chaplain. And we were going up there, and opposite us was a small family in a crowded train, absolutely packed, as we went up grinding through the rock of the Eiger. We got talking to this family. We found they came from East Berlin, their first holiday, out of East Berlin. It was catching, infectious. You caught the excitement they had. We said at the top, well, if you'd like to come with us and run with us, we'll get you to the observatory. It was the first train up in the morning, very early in the morning. And you'll be able to get a view. They came with us. They came up to the top of the observatory. He said, fantastic, fantastic, fantastic. We took him down again. We went out into the snow. Fantastic, is it? Fantastic. And later on, we were back down on the station, further down towards the valley. He pushed his way through the crowd and said, fantastic. Is that how you feel about Christ? That's what it means. Wonderful deeds. Marvellous light. Fantastic. So, how's your health? Are you a people of celebration, affirmation, transformation, and dedication? Well, we all need some rejuvenating, including me. So let's end the passage as Peter does. Once you were no people, now you are God's people. What a statement. Once you had not received mercy, now you have received mercy. Let's praise God for that marvellous privilege given to us by his grace.